Next case for argument this morning is Talley against the United States Department of Agriculture. Mr. Whitaker.
May it please the Court, Henry Whitaker on behalf of the Department of Agriculture. This report's judgment should be reversed because there is no clear and unmistakable evidence that Congress waived the sovereign immunity of the United States when it amended the Fair Credit Reporting Act in 1996 to impose liability on persons.
Mr. Whitaker, was sovereign immunity raised in the district court?
Yes, Judge Rovner, it certainly was raised, and we moved to dismiss on sovereign immunity grounds, and the district court denied that motion. And the district court's order denying that motion is reproduced in our appendix in the blue brief.
Thank you.
And I think that conclusion that Congress did, the language here is not sufficiently clear to affect a waiver, is evident from the two Supreme Court decisions on which we principally rely, the Department of Public Health case and the Library of Congress versus Shaw case. And in both of those cases, the Supreme Court held that where you have a waiver that is arguable from a combination of two different statutory enactments enacted at different times, that if a subsequent amendment is alleged to have waived sovereign immunity, Congress must somehow explicitly refer to governments in that amendment itself. And there is no evidence in the history or text of the 1996 amendments that Congress intended to impose this kind of liability on the United States on the same terms as private parties. And in that regard, it's particularly telling that Section 1681 UI of the Fair Credit Reporting Act contains a very specific yet carefully limited waiver of sovereign immunity for a violation of that particular provision of the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
You know, Mr. Whitaker, I would assume that between DOA loans, housing loans, student loans, and the like, the federal government is probably the largest lender in the nation. Do you mean to say that if the federal government runs its lending program completely incompetently and does to hundreds of thousands what happened to Wayne Talley, that these people have no remedy to be made?
Once
their credit is sullied, what?
No, Your Honor. I believe that Mr. Talley, in particular, would have had a potential remedy available for this kind of conduct under the Privacy Act. And what the Privacy Act says in 5 U.S.C. Section 552b12 is that before this kind of credit information that's contained in a record can be disclosed to a creditor, that United States agencies must follow certain procedures. And those procedures are set forth in 31 U.S.C. Section 3711e. And what those procedures provide is the various protections to these kind of debtors. For example, the head of the agency must approve the disclosure. The debtor must be given an opportunity to dispute the disclosure. And yet Mr. Talley did not proceed in this case under the Privacy Act, and it's telling that the remedies in the Privacy Act are carefully limited. For example, unlike the Fair Credit Reporting Act, there's certainly no provision that purports to impose punitive damage liability on the United States, number one. And number two, even with respect to compensatory damage liability, there's only compensatory damage liability for willful conduct. And that's exactly the opposite of what Congress provided for in the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which provides for, and in this case, it's notable that the district court held that the department's conduct in this case was not willful, because Mr. Talley asked the district court to impose not only compensatory damage liability on the United States, but also punitive damage liability in the United States, notwithstanding the fact that in his brief to this court, he takes the position that the statute doesn't even authorize punitive damage liability against the United States. And with respect, I think the Supreme Court has made clear in those two cases that before Congress would take the extraordinary step of imposing punitive damage liability on the United States, it must be more clear than what it was here.
What in your view would be more clear than 1681A sub B, which just defines public bodies as persons?
Well,
Do you think there should be a final sentence that goes, we really mean it, exclamation point?
No, Your Honor.
Or maybe exclamation point, exclamation point.
Certainly not, Your Honor. I think what Congress could have done is what exactly what it did in the Equal Credit Opportunity Act.
Well, it wasn't writing on a clean slate, though. It came into that statute as it existed and amended it. It was not creating a whole new statute. And this Department of Public Works case, or Public Health case you cite, that's an 11th Amendment case, right?
It is, Your Honor.
And that's different, isn't it? Because the states, by the Constitution, are guaranteed freedom from the federal courts unless explicitly waived.
No, Your Honor, it's not different. And it's actually conceded in this case that cases interpreting the clarity with respect to state waivers of immunity, and the plaintiff talks about this on pages 7 and 8 of the red brief, those principles are analogously applicable to waivers of federal sovereignty. And this court held that very recently in the Nelson versus Miller case, which I'd be happy to submit a supplemental authority, and that's at 570 F3rd 868 at page 884-85. So I think those cases are instructive. But with respect to your question, Your Honor, about what Congress would have needed to have done here, I think, again, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act in the liability provisions themselves contain reference to governmental bodies.
Well, of course. If you amend a statute that doesn't provide liability against governmental bodies and you want to provide liability against governmental bodies, then as part of the amendment, you've got to provide that. What we have here is a case that already applies to governmental bodies and is later amended to add some new clause. Why do you have in the amendment to add another reference to governmental bodies when it's already in the statute?
Well, I think that the reason you have that is the same reason that the Supreme Court held you needed to have in the Department of Public Health case. I mean, what you had there was the Fair Labor Standards Act was in 1966 was amended to include as among the employees that were covered by the statute state hospitals, and yet the Supreme Court held that notwithstanding the fact that the statute contained a pre-existing provision imposing private liability on employers, the Supreme Court held that even though it appeared on its face to have that cross-reference, that was insufficiently clear because Congress, and Your Honor, you're certainly right that Congress does legislate against the backdrop of that definition, but it also legislates against the backdrop.
Yes, actually, as the Supreme Court is very fond of saying, and I think Justice Scalia especially, Congress is presumed to know what's in the statute books when it amends them.
Certainly, Your Honor, but Congress is also...
You're asking us to presume that Congress is a bunch of blithering idiots. Now, whether or not that's factually correct, it's not something that a court ought to presume.
We're certainly not submitting that Congress is a bunch of blithering idiots, Your Honor. And what you do also presume, though, and Justice Scalia himself has noted this in several cases, you also presume that Congress legislates against the backdrop of the canon of sovereign of the waiver of sovereign immunity, as construed by the Supreme Court of the United States. And again, in two cases, in 1973 and 1986, the Supreme Court, I think, construed analytically indistinguishable statutes not to be sufficiently clear. So a Congress aware of both that language and that canon would not necessarily have thought that this would affect the waiver. And the Shaw case is particularly telling in this regard, because what the Shaw case held was that when Congress amended Title VII in 1972, and Your Honor, I'll just finish my point. I see I'm in my rebuttal time. But in 1972, when it added a waiver of sovereign immunity to Title VII, notwithstanding the fact that the statute contained an explicit cross-reference to a provision saying that the United States was liable for fees on the same terms as private parties, the court said that the United States was not liable for interest. And so I think that a Congress legislating in light of those interpretations would not have thought, even if
they asked the question in a different way. What, in your view, does 1681A sub B actually provide?
Your Honor, I think what that provision is doing, and we is just...
Maybe I'm not sufficiently clear. If it doesn't apply to the federal government, it certainly can't apply to the states. And then it sounds like you have just read the reference to governmental bodies completely out of the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
No, Your Honor. We agree that provision would subject the United States to the Fair Credit Reporting Act substantive provisions and would impose substantive duties on the United States. And it's conceivable, although we don't have a definitive position on that today, that that could be enforced through, in addition to, through the Privacy Act, as I've described, through the Administrative Procedure Act, although that may or may not be true, but it's certainly conceivable that someone who alleges that the United States has been...
I'm completely lost. Forget the Privacy Act. Forget the Administrative Procedure Act. They separately create liabilities and duties on the part of the United States. I'm trying to figure out what you think the reference to governmental bodies in 1681A sub B does all by its lonesome.
All by its lonesome self, Your Honor, what it does is, and we do agree that that definition in and of itself refers to governments, including state governments and the federal government. And what it does is it makes clear that when the Fair Credit Reporting Act, in its substantive provisions, mentions persons, and it does impose substantive duties on persons, that the United States is subject to those substantive duties. So we are not free. I mean, we are not free to violate the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And, of course, the United States does take pains.
I don't understand why not, on your view, if you say that that language is not sufficiently clear to subject the United States to liability, then it just doesn't subject the United States to duties either. I don't see any way to distinguish duties from liability for failing to comply with duties.
Your Honor, actually, that's exactly the distinction the Supreme Court made in the Department of Public Health case. Because what the court said there was, yes, that state hospitals and other institutions were subject to the substantive provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act. And yet, the court said that because the clear statement rule applies to the damages provisions and not the rest of the statute, that drew a distinction. And I think that the court it would be completely consistent with that case to make exactly the same distinction here, namely that the Fair Credit Reporting Act, it may well impose substantive legal duties on the federal government, but because there is a clear statement required with respect to the liability provisions purporting to impose monetary liability, that the mere fact that it's subject to those substantive duties does not necessarily mean and can't mean, in light of the clear statement rule, that it's also subject to suits for statutory penalties, punitive damages, and even, and indeed, potentially enforcement actions by state governments, which would be an extraordinary conclusion that Congress could not have contemplated in 1996 when it amended the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And you do look at you and that, but Your Honor, I see that my time is up, but I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Mr. Whitaker. Mr. Radville.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Prior to 1996, Section 1681N and O of the FCRA provided for liability against, quote, any consumer reporting agency or user of information, end quote. In 1996, Congress deleted that language from the FCRA and replaced, quote, any consumer reporting agency or user of information, end quote, with, quote, any person, end quote, extending liability to any person as defined by the Act. Any person as defined by the FCRA, Section 1681AF, to include any, quote, government or governmental subdivision or agency, end quote.
Yeah, well, look, as I understand the federal argument, particularly as articulated by Mr. Whitaker at the end, it's the classic sovereign immunity argument, which is that liability of the United States requires two statutes. Statute number one creates the substantive duty. Statute number two, some separate statute, is needed to create liability, to waive the government's sovereign immunity. And if I understand Mr. Whitaker correctly, he's saying 1681A sub B is statute number one, that is, it subjects the United States to substantive duties. But there is no statute number two waiving sovereign immunity and allowing a remedy. Now, if I were in your position, I would point to the Little Tucker Act and say that the Little Tucker Act generally waives the sovereign immunity of the United States for claims under $10,000. So that what you want to do is put 1681A sub B together with the Little Tucker Act. But have you made such an argument?
We have not, Your Honor. if I do understand your question, and if I will do my best to address it, we look to the Supreme Court case cited by the United States, which is Department of Public Health and Welfare. And, Your Honor, actually noted correctly, it is a question of where, not whether. The Supreme Court reached the issue as to where a state may be sued, not whether a state may be sued in the act. Of course, it was an 11th Amendment federal powers case. However, they did note, if in fact we were to reach the conclusion as to whether, we would have found that the interplay between the two provisions, the definition and the liability, does waive sovereign immunity. We look to Justice Douglas speaking for the majority, quote, at page 287, arguably that permits suits in the Missouri courts, but that is a question we do not reach.
So, state cases, it seems to me, don't cut much ice one way or the other. I'm interested in the straightforward argument. You can find this in most of the Supreme Court's sovereign immunity jurisprudence. Their argument, what the Supreme Court says is that getting money damages from the United States needs two statutes, not one. Statute A creates the duty. Statute B creates the money remedy. Right? And what you're pointing to in 1681A-B creates the duty, and you need a separate money-creating statute. And that's where I'm trying to figure out where we go. Now, the Tucker Act is a money-creating statute. It says the government has to pay damages for any violation of a statutory duty. If the amount is $10,000 or under, it's in the district court. That's the Little Tucker Act. If it's greater than $10,000, it's in the Court of Federal Claims. But that's just for compensatory damages and not for punitive damages. So if I get the U.S. argument correctly, it is, although they haven't talked about the Tucker Act, what one would say is the Fair Credit Reporting Act imposes the substantive duty. You have to find elsewhere the waiver. But it turns out if you look at the Tucker Act, that waiver isn't going to get you punitive damages. It's going to be something like that. And it's hard to see why that argument is wrong. That leaves work for 1681A sub B to do while preserving this Supreme Court two-step approach.
And I cannot disagree with Your Honor. Of course, as I noted, we did not raise the issue as to the Tucker Act. Our point is simply that the interplay between the provisions, Section A and Section N and O, of course, waive the sovereign immunity of the United States. And we take that from the United States Supreme Court and Department of Public Health and Welfare and the Fifth Circuit in Moore versus the Department of Agriculture when they looked at a statutory scheme identical to what we have here today, the definition and the liability and the interplay between the two, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. And the court noted, the Fifth Circuit noted, yes, this does in fact waive sovereign immunity. In fact, they use the exact language, and I quote, unequivocally expresses Congress' intentions.
Look, that you're not dealing with my question. You're just saying the United States is unequivocally subject to some duty.
Right.
Just last year, the Supreme Court had a case involving the fiduciary duty toward Indians about oil revenues. There's a statute unequivocally subjecting the Department of the Interior to fiduciary duties when licensing minerals on behalf of Indian tribes. But the Supreme Court held that it did not subject the United States to money damages because there was no separate statute saying that a violation of that fiduciary duty is compensable in cash. Right? That's the stripe of argument that's being made here. The statute unequivocally applies to the United States, but there's no separate statute providing for money, unless it's maybe the Tucker Act. And I'm still trying to figure out how one responds to that argument, and you can't respond to it just by saying, given 1681A sub B, the United States is unequivocally subject to duties.
Correct. And again, I may be misunderstanding Your Honor's question, and I cannot speak to the Tucker Act as we did not raise it, and it's not in our briefs. But what I will say is we look to N and we look to O, subsections N and subsections O, which of course are the liability section, which of course reference any person, which of course subject the United States or any person to damages, and that being actual damages and punitive damages. And to address the point about punitive damages that the United States made with respect to the FBI case, Section U, the United States is subjected to punitive damages with respect to 1681U. It's actually directly in the language of the Act. And there's a question as to why United States, the term United States, was used in Section 1681U. And of course, well, not of course, but I believe it to be that the United States does not want to subject the states to liability for acts of federal agents and the employees of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is why they used United States in that case, and they used government or governmental subdivisions and agencies in the previous definition in subsection A of the Act. The United States also addressed the case Library of Congress versus Shaw, and in that case, a waiver of immunity was in fact found. It was found with respect to liability. It was found with respect to damages, just not interest on those damages. So, in fact, the United States Supreme Court took the position of the United States here today and said, there is a waiver of sovereign immunity. It is a specific, unequivocal, and unambiguous. And look, it goes to damages, it goes to attorney's fees, just not interest, because there is a longstanding no-interest rule that the Supreme Court has adhered to. Simply, we look to the plain language of the Act. That's where we begin with interpretation, and it is clear. Any person who fails to comply with liability is subject to liability under the FCRA, any person defined as government. We have to assume that Congress understood what it was doing when enacting the amendments in 1996. Now, the Congress, an argument raised by the United States is that there is no policy, no underlying reasoning. Well, the Supreme Court has stated Congress need not specifically articulate its reasons for enacting a statute. That's particularly true in a case like this where there is a line and the line must be drawn. And whether or not that line is drawn here or there is not for the courts to decide, but for the United States Congress to make that decision. We look to the similar acts, the Truth in Lending Act and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and we have the same statutory scheme. Generally, with respect to the idea of criminal punishment, the United States actually addressed that in Moore in their briefs before the Fifth Circuit and actually refuted the argument raised today, saying, look, that's ridiculous. Of course, if the Attorney General does not wish to bring a suit, he or she need not bring a suit. So, in closing, the general purpose of sovereign immunity rests on the principle and the hazard that we don't want to subject governments to suits which may inhibit their ability to function as they need be. We do not believe that this is one such a case. And, Your Honor, I respectfully request that Your Honors affirm the decision of the lower court. If, in fact, there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them to the best of my ability.
Thank you very much, Mr. Radbill. Mr. Whitaker, your time has expired, but I would invite you to come back and address the bearing, if any, of the Tucker Act.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to, Your Honor. As the plaintiff pointed out, the plaintiff hasn't raised the Tucker Act in this case, and we don't think the plaintiff could have raised the Tucker Act in this case because of Section 1681P of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which contains its own distinctive jurisdictional provision, specifically vesting jurisdiction over Fair Credit Reporting Act cases in district courts. And there is a line of cases that hold that where Congress has its distinctive jurisdictional provision, vesting jurisdiction in district courts, that forecloses concurrent Tucker Act jurisdiction under that same statute, which makes sense given that Congress evinced its...
I'm not really interested in arguments about the allocation between the district court and the Court of Federal Claims. I'm interested in the question whether the Tucker Act serves as the waiver of sovereign immunity that's necessary to go with the substantive clauses of the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, but that is relevant to that question because in order for the Tucker Act to provide a waiver of sovereign immunity, the Tucker Act must itself supply a source of jurisdiction, and it must be a money-mandating statute. And as a prerequisite to a money-mandating statute, it must provide a source of jurisdiction. And where Congress has specifically provided for jurisdiction in district courts over a particular claim, there are a line of cases that we'd certainly be happy to address in a supplemental brief if the court would like, holding that does foreclose Tucker Act jurisdiction.
So you think the Regional Rail Reorganization Act cases are wrongly decided?
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not familiar with the Regional Rail Reorganization
Act. That argument was presented to the Supreme Court in the 4R cases and rejected.
Well,
Maybe you think wrongly, although it was presented by the Solicitor General, and he persuaded the Supreme Court to accept it.
Well, Your Honor, we'd be happy to submit, as I said, a supplemental brief addressing that question. But I'm aware, and I think, first of all, that those cases do make sense in that if Congress has specifically vested jurisdiction in district courts over Fair Credit Reporting Act claims without regard to amount in controversy, it really doesn't make much sense to say that Congress would also have wanted the Little Tucker Act to provide a source of jurisdiction in district court, which limits the claims to $10,000. So under plaintiff's view, if the Tucker Act would provide a waiver, that would mean that claims over $10,000 would have to go to the – presumably would have to go to the Court of Federal Claims. And that's extremely odd when you – at least when they are against the United States. And that is extremely odd when you way to read 1681P. In any event, I think – quite apart from the jurisdictional provision itself, the statute, it's not enough for the Little Tucker Act to provide a waiver that the statute imposed substantive obligations on the United States. It must also be true that the statute must be a money-mandating statute. And so if Congress did not provide for civil liability in 1681 N and O of the United States, then the Little Tucker Act can't be a money-mandating statute, I think.
Now sounds like you're saying the Tucker Act is always irrelevant. If there's a provision for money in the underlying statute, the Tucker Act is not needed. If there is not a provision for money in the underlying statute, then the Tucker Act can't provide it. Ergo, the Tucker Act doesn't exist.
No, Your Honor. I mean, I think our position depends on the fact, again, principally on the distinctive jurisdictional provision that exists under the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Whitaker. The case is taken under advisement.